How do financiers and donor funders ensure they are avoiding project duplication? Or even worse, ensure that they are not allowing critical interventions to go unnoticed and unactioned? Hi, I'm Claire Fulkvay, and this is the EndLit Africa podcast. We spoke to Wim Jonker Kluna about this very challenge, and he shared some interesting insights into a new initiative called the Solar Home Funders Group. Hi, Wim. It's so lovely to have the opportunity to speak to you.
I'm also glad to be on the line with you, so I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Me too. And I do have to ask, what is the Household Solar Funders Group, and why was this group put together?
That's a very good question indeed. This group basically brings together all funders of household solar in Africa. Household solar being small solar home systems, but also solar lanterns, productive use associated with that, all at the household level. This group was put together basically as a follow-up on an earlier initiative, which was called SOCH, Scaling Off-Grid Energy, which was a collaborative effort between African Development Bank, USAID, Power Africa, the Shell Foundation, and FCDO, the previously DFID. They found it very useful to regularly meet, discuss their activities, and see how they could align what they were doing to each other, and actually make sure that, one, there wasn't overlap between activities, but certainly also to see that there weren't gaps in what they were offering. When that collaborative effort came to an end and they did an evaluation, they actually really valued that exchange of information working together, but also realized that there were only five vendors in the whole field and that they really wanted to become more overarching over what is happening in African household solar. So that was basically where the Household Solar Funders Group was initiated. That was back in 2019. I was asked to put the group together to bring all the different funders active in that field together. So we're not only talking about donors, but we're also talking about real investors, impact investors, commercial investors, foundations, philanthropies, and everything. And see how this individual entities that form the group can work together on areas where it will be very difficult for them on their own to do an activities, but rather do an activity together and basically try to see how we can attract more funding towards the sector and assist in reaching SDG 7 on energy access by 2030 indeed.
And you mentioned that there are some key priorities for the Solar Home Funders Group. And I was wondering if you could possibly share some insight into what these are, both from a regional perspective and also perhaps from a thematic perspective.
Yeah, certainly. Basically, what we did when we had the first meeting of the group, which actually did have about 37 organizations represented and about 50 participants. So it was quite a large group to have a proper discussion. So we did preparatory work with surveys and individual one-on-one discussions with members. But basically, we tried to identify areas where it makes sense for the funders to work together. And we came to three priority areas. Those are not necessarily the key priority areas for the household solar sector as such, but areas where our members have a clear wish and indication that they want to learn from each other and work together with each other. So those three areas are support of local companies. Mm-hmm. It's looking into demand side subsidies. And the third group is looking into productive use of energy. And each of those topics, we formed a working group that is seeing what exactly is the current status of activities and how can the funders work together on that one. Just to give an example, on the demand side subsidies, we all agree that there is some kind of a need for demand side subsidies to reach really the people that can't afford solar home systems. But there are very few programs in on the ground that actually have done that. So we share information and we see whether the funders can do something together to advance on that topic.
So working on the assumption that not everybody works in this particular segment of the sector to the same level that you do, could you perhaps explain, for instance, what the support of local companies might entail, what productive use of energy is, and what a demand-side subsidy might be, and how that could be implemented, or why these three areas in particular are so important?
Yeah, now let me do that. Let's start with the support of local companies. If we honestly look at what has been funded by funders up till now, we see that a large proportion of the companies that have been funded are either foreign companies or foreign-owned companies and not necessarily indigenous African companies. We all agree that it would be very good to support local companies because they have the local knowledge, they can bring in the economic development that we require, etc., and they've proven to be more sustainable in the long term. But we see that funders have not funded them, at least in the past. They all have an intention to do that, but they really need to understand what should change to make that happen. And then we're not only talking about how should those local companies change, but also look at how should the funders change? How should they two come much closer together that eventually it will be possible to have more local companies in portfolios of funders. At the moment, the funders group is really exchanging information, learning from each other, but also identifying which funder is active at what stage of development of a company so that they can refer a potential applicant to another funder if they're not really fit into their own portfolio. Also looking into what technical assistance is available to assist those companies and how can we make sure that that is available to the companies that really do need it. So it is really identifying who's active where and identifying where can the funders do things together, because a lot of funders are targeting similar type of companies, but certainly to understand how should they approach local solar companies. And does that entail working with local banks? Does it entail working with local chambers of commerce? Or should it be something completely different? So that's really what does that working group is looking at. Mm-hmm. For demand side subsidies, what we currently see is that if you go to, let's say, the more remote areas, a lot of people don't have the financial means to purchase an energy system, in our case, looking at solar systems. So there is an affordability gap. That affordability gap could potentially be covered through a subsidy using public funding, like also grid extensions are being publicly funded and being subsidized. So what we're looking at is, how do we identify those users that actually do need a subsidy? And what type of models are available to ensure that that subsidy can eventually reach that customer? Should it go directly to the customer? Should it go through the local companies that provide the service? What other options are there? And really trying to understand what is the best approach on reaching really those customers that have that affordability gap. And then the last one on productive use of energy, that's really looking into areas where you use energy that's been provided to produce something, as the name says. But an example is, for example, solar irrigation, where you have solar pumps that can pump water and you don't have to do manual harvesting of water, things like that.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you would think that people, for those of us who have grown up with easy access to electricity. The assumption is, well, if you have, you know, when you get it, you should know what to do with it. But it's never quite as simple as that. And unless the opportunities are highlighted, a lot of that energy that is being provided will go underutilized. And that, of course, would be a terrible sort of tragedy, I guess, both from a development perspective, but also from an investment perspective.
Yeah, certainly. I think you're very right in that one. I think there is a lot of also consumer awareness needed, indeed, how they can and are able to use the energy that is available. We might have to do one step before that and look into how they can afford that energy. But as you say correctly, I mean, that energy can be an enabler for economic development. The people need indeed to know how to use that energy. So that should be an integral part of anything you do on rural electrification anyway.
I guess it's, you know, I was talking to my daughter the other day and she was telling me that they are busy learning visualization at school. So how even in English, you know, images and cartoons can convey messages. And it's almost, you know, if the schools are looking at that level of, I guess, diversification from the more traditional route type learning, it would make sense for them to start including things like usage of energy, energy efficiency, energy safety, just as part of the general curriculum.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. And I think I also like the fact that you say she's looking into how to visualize that, because we also should realize that particularly if you go to deep rural areas where people don't have energy access and want to provide them with energy access, they not necessarily speak the English that we speak, or they speak a local language. And visualization of a lot of those issues might actually help there as well. So I think that was also something when you start to tell about your daughter, that I thought, yeah, that's also something that we should look at. It's not just that we write a manual in English and it will happen. We really should engage with the end users, and visualizations might be a very powerful tool into that. I mean, we should also make sure that people do understand the type of energy service they get and what you can expect from it. Mm. I mean, it's still quite difficult to do ironing on the solar home system. So we shouldn't also raise expectations of things that are not going to happen. But I think it's important indeed that whatever we do on providing energy services, we make sure that the final end user does actually understand what he or she is getting, what they can do with it, and how it can improve their life. I mean, it can be a very powerful tool for economic development, for improvement of lives, as long as you use it properly.
Mm. If I could perhaps just go back to the demand side subsidies. This is obviously, it's kind of one of those like chicken and egg situations, because you can't get the power if you don't have the money, but you don't necessarily have the money because you don't have the power. What sort of examples have you seen with regards to demand side subsidies that have been perhaps utilized in Africa?
There are very few examples at this stage, but the government of Rwanda has quite an extensive program that actually quite recently went from a pilot stage to a national program using money from the fiscus. So using, let's say, their own money, not donor funding, mm-hmm. where they have identified, if I'm not mistaken, three levels of subsidy required, depending on the socioeconomic status of an end user. Rwanda obviously is quite well organized and have quite a lot of data on the population. So if you fall in a certain category, you do qualify for a 90% subsidy of the solar home system, a 45% subsidy, a percent subsidy, or something else, depending really where you are. And that's just a program where private sector providers or service providers of solar systems can sell a system at a reduced price to someone that qualifies and can put in a claim to the Rand Development Bank for the remainder of the funding to match that affordability gap. So that's one of the very successful examples of demand-side subsidies. Togo is doing something similar. Kenya has a program. I know that in the DRC, they're about to launch a program. But at the moment, that's as far as we've got as a sector.
With regards to the support of local companies, does that support include skills development, or is it really purely on the financial side?
Definitely more than just the financial side. I mean, there is a lot of support already available for local companies that actually the companies might not be aware of, but also some of the investors might not be aware of. Basically, what you will see is that a lot of local companies might have very good business ideas, but might not, for example, have put it in a proper business plan that an investor is looking for. So there is support available to system in putting that on paper, thinking that through, have all scenarios and things like that. So it's definitely more than just pure funding. It's really support the companies in reaching a stage that they also can become a sustainable company. And that does require capacity building of the company and funding. The two of them go hand in hand.
Is this only available to private sector companies in terms of the support? Or is this something that might be of benefit to, say, a local utility or a rural electrification agency?
It's not purely limited to private sector entities. Basically, it depends actually on the priorities of the different funders. I mean, remember, the group just brings the funders together. We don't have our own funding. It's really see how the different funding streams that are available can be aligned. And certainly, a number of the funders do support those entities you mentioned. So they are included, yes.
Okay. If you were to, focus in on the most important takeaway from today's conversation, what would that be?
That it is, I think you summarized it quite nicely. It some things look quite simple, and we assume certain things or take certain things for granted. And I think that's something that we should look at and step back at what we've been doing and what we intend to do, and see, is this indeed as logic as it seems for us to the other party? If you look at the example you give for the local company support, a lot of the investors, it is quite logic that you would start with a business plan. While for some of the local companies, perhaps it's more logic just to roll out, do sales and have organic growth. So I think, and that was also, that came back in our discussion, and that I see in the funders group as well. We should really be all looking at a broader range, looking into both sides of the equation and see how we can really come together and set aside what we assume should be the logical way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, a lot of our assumptions are based by our experience. So if you have been part of a more formalized education system, you have certain things that are part of that system, and therefore you take them for granted. But if you've never had that benefit, it doesn't mean that you are any less likely to succeed, but it's just that your perception of what is normal is completely different to somebody else.
Yeah, correct. I can give a very simple example of that one. I mean, I'm at a certain stage, I did supervise a student from Europe that went to see a small hydro plant in Mozambique. And he came back to me and said, they're wasting energy. They're wasting a lot of energy. Well, during the day, the lights are on. I don't understand that. They should change that. His background was coming from Europe, and most probably seen the age also being exposed with a parent that was exposed to the oil crisis. There you're automatically being forced that if you leave a room, you switch up the light because you save energy. But when you have a mini grid run on hydro, either you keep the light on or the energy being wasted anyway. And in most cases, what they will do is they put it in a dump load and heat river water. So in that particular situation, his mindset of how he was grown up, how he was supposed to work with energy, did override actually the actual reality of the technical reality of the mini grid. So I think, a very important issue.
Yeah. And anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the work that is being done? We are hoping to welcome you at the Inlit Africa conference in June, where we're going to be having a bit of a round table and discuss some of these issues in more depth. But besides that, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I definitely will join you in June, that's for sure. what I would like to add is that I see a genuine will, a genuine effort by the different funders to work more together. We've seen a lot of working in silos, and I think we all agree now that that is not the best approach. Mm. And I'm encouraged by the different funders and actually a large number of funders that joined the group, many more than we originally expected, that they really want to see how they can move forward, do things differently than they used to do, and also do things together. That we don't necessarily have to plant our own flag every time we do something, but really see that what we do will assist the sector to advance.
Yeah, it always seems a little bit silly to me when you hear that people are doing the same thing, and in some cases in the same country, and yet they're not talking to one another, because I would assume, and again, this is here, it's my assumption about what makes logical sense, that together they could have more impact than on their own. And I realize that it's not quite as simple as that. There's always a million other considerations, but I do love the fact that everybody's working together. They're working toward common objectives, and there's an element of coordination in the effort, because I think that that is something that has perhaps been lacking in the sector for a very long time.
Yeah, I think that's the right conclusion. And I think what I really like to see from this House of Solar Funders group is that it's not becoming yet another talk group. I don't want us to meet and say, listen, we agree we should do A, B, and C. And in the next meeting, agree that we agree to do that. We really are focused on getting something tangible happening, that people are really doing something together, and that really gets some results coming out of that.
Well, let's hope that our discussions in June then are going to contribute even one step towards some of those tangible results. Vim, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. It's been really wonderful to have the opportunity to speak with you.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on this Inlit Africa podcast. This episode is brought to you in partnership with ESI Africa. For more podcasts, you can visit the Inlit Africa website, inlit-africa.com, or via the ESI Africa website, esi-africa.com. Be sure to tune in again soon for more conversations and insights into the things that really matter to Africa's energy industry. Until next time, I'm Claire Volkveen, and you've been listening to the Inlit Africa podcast.